the fight never stops. It ain't gonna stop for me until I stop breathing. It's one of those things that needs to be fought. The more people that help fight it, the better off it is.
Well, we've been talking KBO Community Radio. KB is an Casey is an AIC who got out about 5 months ago. So, Casey, again, congratulations on getting out. Thank congratulations you. On your new life. Thank best you. Wishes to you.
Thank you.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello. 1, 2, 3. Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
Well, hello. What's this? Would you look at that? It's KBOO's special Earth Day Marathon coming up on Tuesday, April 22nd. Looks like it'll feature local environmental advocates, native perspectives, earth-conscious music, radio shows en español, and plenty of nature sounds. A full day's worth, it looks like. KBOO's Earth Day programming kicks off on Monday, April 21st at 10 p.m. and runs through 10 p.m. Tuesday. All the information is online at kboo.fm/earthday. That's kboo.fm/earthday. Leave it better than you found it.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
It is Hard Knock Radio, Davey D, hanging out with you this afternoon. As you know, earlier this year we started a series, or we've been participating in a series called Build and Fight Formula. It is brought to you by our comrades, Tondi Chemerenga, who we know from Black Liberation Media, and our sister station KPFK in LA, and Kalian Kuno, who is with Cooperation Jackson in Mississippi. This is a series of survival analysis, tips, marching orders, and a deep dive into the issues that are facing us today. This is part three of a 9-part series. It aired live last night, and we are replaying this for you today on Hard Knock Radio. A lot of information is being disseminated, especially around the topic of food justice. So we want you to pull up a chair, take a deep listen, and really act accordingly. Act upon the information that is given.
Greetings, everyone. This is Tondesizwe Shimaringa coming to you on Tuesday, April 8th with a special edition of Rootwork. This is the Build and Fight Formula, a series of educational sessions sponsored by Cooperation Jackson and presenting Kali Akuno, co-founder and co-director of Cooperation Jackson based in Jackson, Mississippi, with this Build and Fight Formula, a plan for the transformation of society. This is our third, I do believe, is it not, Kali?
That is correct. Our third installment, if you would.
A third installment of about 8, 9, 10, 11, a whole year's worth of work.
Yeah,
that's what we have for folks, right?
That's right. That's right. We'll be going through December. And given the new circumstances of Trumpflation and we got to come up with a new coin of phrase. He wants to call it Liberation Day. I think I want to call it Peonage Day, but we'll play with it. But much of what folks like myself have been warning was coming to pass is now here. And I think this is going to put what we've been talking about and what we've been planning on sharing, I think, in sharper contrast. But we'll get into it.
Well, can you do a brief, and I mean extremely brief, can you do a brief recap of what we've been talking about before we get into today's discussion?
The first one was in our series, which, let me do a bit of self-promotion. Folks,
brief, look brief, Kali, brief.
I'm working on it. Go back and look at parts one and two. One was the introduction, kind of the argument, if you would, to lay out why this particular rollout of practices and strategies could be transformational, both to deal with the times that we are living in, with the rise of fascism and the ascension of kind of the techno-feudal lords like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel. And the first one got into kind of the first element of what we would call a building block, which is mutual aid, what it is, why we need it, and how it should work to build solidarity within our communities to overcome some of the programming and socialization we've all had to endure the last 40 plus years of neoliberalism, which has fractured our communities, created a bunch of reactionary politics, primarily focused in and around identity that's often devoid of any form of class analysis, but trying to lay out within that why it is so necessary to build the type of unity and solidarity to build a kind of a new society, but also some of the building blocks. So I would definitely want to encourage folks to go back and look at sessions one and two. This is the deliberate third one, which is trying to take up where that comes off. And so the piece around food sovereignty, number one, is just to deal with our folks, need to survive and have their caloric needs met, their nutritional needs met. But how do we ascertain that information if we're trying to produce based upon use values, right? Producing for what people need first and foremost, rather than producing commodities. How do we ascertain what people need? That is where a fundamental component of the mutual aid, that's why it's number one, is there. For us to start determining that need on a community, communal basis that does not rely upon creating these extensive database programs that either the government would control or private corporations would control. And how it's integrated in what you see here around, if you look at one of the bottom points, the need around open source technologies of how we have to gather this information in non-invasive ways so we know what people need and we can start planning and producing towards that and then distribute it on a need-based basis based upon enhancing people's participation in broad community production. So there's an integrated piece that we're going to get into. And this, what you see, you know, before you in this graphic, I'm not going to read it all today, just in the interest of time. But definitely check it out on our website. It will be posted here on video and all of our social media posts on Facebook, Instagram, X, and some of the other new platforms that we're going to get into. So hopefully that gives a short summary, Tunda Seizwe, and we can be.
All right. So now what are we talking about today? What are we talking about? What are we talking about?
Well, first, I think we need to address what's going on in the world and how this fits in, right? So one of the reasons why we need to push to enhance food production in our communities is to deal with the threat of food being used as a weapon against our people, against our communities. And do not take that lightly by any stretch of the imagination. I know some people, when I've made this claim, you know, want to cite that how readily accessible food is in this country. Well, if you look at the history of famines, and I'm going to give a shout out to another L.A. boy, Mike Davis, may he rest in peace, who wrote a book about pandemics and famines, right, that were associated with what we would now call climate change, that he specifically identified as El Nino. I want y'all to go look that book up. But one of the critical things is to understand, like, you know, the famine that happened in India during the British Empire days, the famine that happened in Ireland during those Empire days, those were planned and calculated activities. It was not because there was a lack of food or that food production had collapsed. It was that it was commodified and controlled in such a way that it could not and would not be distributed to the folks who were working the land. The same thing happened here in the United States in the 1930s. And many of y'all who know about the Dust Bowl, go look it up if you're not familiar with that in the 1930s. And the overproduction of food that was taking place in California at the same time. That was a period in which California started to become the breadbasket, not only of the United States, but for a stretch, a good stretch of time, the world. Well, they were burning food in California during critical stretches of their period of the 1930s in order to maintain commodity prices, right, rather than give it away. So it's not a question of whether enough food is being produced. We already produce enough food just in the United States alone.
The United States alone. The United States throws away enough food.
Thank you. Thank you. It was just where I was about to go to. So it's a matter of who owns and controls the means of production and how those who own and control the means of production distribute it for a profit rather than for need. And we are struggling, and what this program is about is to start producing for need, to enhance that struggle, but also to prepare our people and our communities for some hard times ahead. And so what we have been warning about, you know, anybody's listening to me the last maybe 10 years have been warning that a movement like the MAGA movement was coming and that it was in planning on doing intentional damage not only to the U.S. economy, to the world economy. And well, as we saw last, you know, we've been seeing the last 3 months, they mean good on what they promised and they are executing. As he himself, you know, as my firstborn says, Cheeto Hitler was promising to wreak havoc, and here it is. And so we need to get prepared, y'all. You know, so I want to go back and start encouraging anybody who is listening to this to start organizing mutual aid, you know, collectives, or if you're already in an organization, you know, mobilize it and organize it to start doing mutual aid, but combine that with doing food production on a communal scale. And rather than just talking about food sovereignty, let me try to just sum that up. briefly. Emphasize your brief. You know, look, food sovereignty means being able to produce, in short, it means us as a communities being able to produce what we need to take care of our caloric intakes and our health, right? Because food should also be a means to health, not just, you know, eating to be full, but to take care of our medical needs, to control diabetes, control all these different things. And I'm stressing the control, because how the current food systems are set up in the United States and other so-called, you know, first world, really the core imperialist countries, food primarily is cheaper in its mass, produced form than it is in its natural state. What do I mean by that? It is often cheaper to get a meal at McDonald's for many, despite its poor nutritional value, than it is to actually go buy, organically fed, cows or healthy, fruits, vegetables, cheeses, except rice, etc. that you need. It's often cheaper to go the other route because of the nature of how the food systems are organized and controlled, as I keep referencing. So food sovereignty means breaking that dependence, but we only break that dependence by enhancing local production and then setting up new systems of distribution that align with that production to provide to those who need the most, and a basis that they can either kind of trade value for it, or it is directly affordable. Now, keep in mind, this is not what's the word I'm looking for? This is not like some pie in the sky thing. And despite what most of us have been taught in the United States about the overall, capacity of the American agricultural might, most food in the world is still produced by small producers, throughout the world. And what I want folks to do, just to cite, we're doing more to try to cite resources and folks to understand how a lot of this is already being, played out and experimented in the world. I want everybody to look up La Via Campesina, which is one of the largest social movements on the planet. It is an organization of small producers and farmers all throughout the world, mainly concentrated in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, and understand how they are focusing in. It's them who's kind of really innovated this whole concept of food sovereignty, so folks know, and to give credit where credit is due. But also how it's pushed to agroecology, right? Or as we say it sometimes in our movement, afroecology principles, which some people might know by an earlier term, which has some misappropriation to a permaculture, right? But we want to use the term either afroecology or agroecology to define it in such a way that you're not relying on production methods that rely on a lot of pesticides, a lot of inorganic fertilizers, where it's just souped up with a bunch of industrial chemicals that produce sometimes tremendous yields, but actually destroy your soils. And remember, or if you didn't know outside it here, that everything that we call civilization is really dependent upon about 6 inches of topsoil, which takes millions of years for the earth to organically produce. And the nature of the capitalist and imperialist system and its total, I'm gonna use the offensive word, rape of the earth and its natural resources, and the total extraction is depleting that soil all over the world, depleting the earth of its water reserves, particularly fresh water reserves, by destroying aquifers. Those are the water that exists underground. Those of you in California should know well of what I'm talking about, how that is potentially being wasted and dried up and overutilized and appropriated by this industrial farming system that the United States employs. We're not talking about replicating that. Let me be clear. We're talking about methods developed by indigenous peoples and various societies over a long period of time, which replenish the soils, keep the nutrients, and keep bountiful yields. But we have to reintroduce those practices, which means repairing the land, restoring ecosystems, right? So when we talk about food sovereignty, you have to also, to be clear, associated with these practices and bringing those into the fray of what you're doing, into the core of what you're doing. But one of the key pieces I want to talk about here, just for the interest of this conversation, for everybody to be clear, we cannot really push this movement or push this whole concept of food sovereignty without really talking about access to land, right? And that is now much more critical than it was, say, even a week before. So I want everybody to be clear about that, because we are going to have to now engage in some serious struggle collectively about accessing land to be able to enhance our productive capacity to meet the broad community need. And this is going to be critical, y'all, because you should expect the price of food to rise in the United States, even by their basic calculations that you can see on CNN and in MSNBC, and even Fox has had to admit that the price of food will probably go up about 10% within the next couple of weeks. And that's just a beginning. If this trade war continues to escalate, which personally I don't see that it won't over a period of time, and let me say why. It's not to be a distraction. Number one, China has stated very clearly today they're not backing down, and that they're going to meet Trump and the United States government tariff for tariff, pound for pound, and if necessary, they said round for round, right? That's where they are at, pushing their agenda, you know, around maintaining their sovereignty and how they see their role in the global stage and what Trump is trying to break. Now, what folks are clearly going to find out right now, they claim that there are 50 countries, if not more, who are knocking at the door trying to beg them for some tariff relief. They're going to find out very quickly, like Canada and Mexico did. That's not what dude is interested in, right? He wants everybody to come kiss the ring. This is economics by pure mafioso extraction, right? You're going to have to pay to play. And there's no way that you can talk about, there's no way folks are going to try to deal with so-called trade imbalances, because that's not how, you know, you don't square up trade like that. If somebody makes a better product and they sell it for cheaper within the capitalist system, they are typically going to win unless there's some other type of market intervention or force. So you can't force folks necessarily to take a cheap product or a bad product that comes from the United States, particularly if the United States ain't even prepared to make that at a cheap price point. So this war is going to escalate and continue. And he
okay,
is
a system.
People need to understand it. Go ahead.
I want you to be brief, but this is all your fault, Kali. I share no responsibility in this whatsoever. I feel the need to ask you a question, even though I want you to be. You said China says it is prepared to go not only pound for pound, but round for round. And you've talked about before, of course, the U.S. wants war with China. Can you explain for our audience, and it's me, I'm the audience, how does what we're dealing with lead to actual boots on the ground, tanks, guns, war?
The last 300 years of capitalist development, trade wars are often a precursor to actual physical wars, mm-hmm. right? You can go back, let's just cite probably the most classic example is World War One, what the Europeans and the North Americans call World War One, right? The first mm-hmm. great inter-imperialist war is what it really was. And what was that about? Carving up the world. And who was going to control what sphere of influence? Who was going to be allowed to trade where? But what preceded that was, this is my zone, and you can't trade your goods in my zone, right? Or if you try to trade your goods in my zone, I'm gonna hit you with a tariff and make mm-hmm. you pay more for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That means somebody's losing out on money, right? And I'm going to go back to another old LA classic. Playing with my money is like playing with my emotions, right? So he is intentionally riling people up. In this case, he's intentionally trying to rile the Chinese up mm-hmm. and make them bow to the United States. But mm-hmm. the reality of the situation is, what folks need to understand, the United States cannot keep up in almost producing anything with the Chinese. Point blank, period. And if you don't believe me, I want you to go listen to some of the speeches Marco Rubio has given the last couple of weeks, and J.D. Vance gave perhaps one of the most important speeches I've ever heard in my lifetime. From a vice president. It was one of the most honest speeches about what globalization, quote unquote, was supposed to do from the imperialist perspective. And he basically laid out, when we started doing global trade, and he's going back to the beginning of the Bretton Woods era, it was for the rich to get richer and the poor to get a little bit better. But it didn't turn out that way, right? It didn't turn out that way because the poor, in this case in particular, the Chinese, right, they caught up, and not only caught up, but exceeded and advanced in their productive capacity to become the workshop of the world. From the period in which they kind of, you know, quote unquote, Nixon opened the Chinese up, you know, to start trading and treating with the United States, to where within our lifetime, Tandy, you will well remember starting to see everything from toys to clothes to cars and everything else in the late 70s and in the early 80s being made in China, right? And that was replacing what we already were growing up with it being so many things being made in Japan. And folks remember that area, and remember in the 1980s how Western capital was hyping up that Japan was outproducing the United States. Now, the Japan's productive capacity never yielded, but their market yielded. And what that has fundamentally meant is that other countries around the world have aggregated their productive capacity to not only match or exceed the United States. And what the United States has been left with and has left itself with, and for that, I want y'all to really to understand that. Well, I want everybody to go look at a video that was done last Friday. I think it's on a show called Dialogue Works, with a masterclass interview about economics, world economics, from Professor Rick Wolf and Michael Hudson, right? Where they really, I think, do a good deal of breaking down everything in layman's terms about how the bond markets may, you know, work, how the United States, from Nixon on, when he destroyed, you know, the pig of the international monetary controls with the gold standard and all that stuff, in 19, you know, was it 71, and let the dollar float and then tied it to what became the petrodollar, how that, you know, turned the U.S. dollar into like it was already the international monetary, you know, the standard monetary currency, which is still fundamentally plays that role in a decreasing sense, but it still basically plays their role. But that allowed the United States to extract through financial means, basically rents from the rest of the world to keep up the quote unquote standard living in the United States. Well, that has resulted in stagnant wages basically since the 1970s for American workers and a decreased standing of living for all of us, right? By comparison, even though we may have Xboxes and plasma TVs or whatever the hell is going on, the overall standard of living of what we can afford in terms of housing or health care is far less than what our grandparents and parents were able to kind of receive, those of us listening to this who are in the United States. So we know very clearly there's been a declining standard of living. And this is something Trump himself played upon, I think, in a masterful way during his campaign, but is now utterly betrayed, even though his rhetoric is still, I'm doing this tariffs to try to bring back manufacturing to the United States. Now, he may have some illusion about that in his mind. I don't think he does. I think he knows it's just a good selling point to keep, in particular, the white working class on his side, right, to throw them some meat on the bone. But he's very clear that for instance, you know, we've talked about this before, but I'll restate it again. Folks need to be clear. Like, if auto manufacturing comes back to the United States, it's not going to be a big job producing engine. because most of that is going to be managed by automation and AI. Mm. That's who's going to be doing that work. Mm. Not me or you, not people like me and you, right? Mm. Even if they don't particularly have our complexion. Mm. That is where that's going to go. And the owner of General Motors even got on the line, and there's a report out where he basically laid out, like, yo, this, if you continue with these tariffs in a particular way, you're going to force us to have to raise the cost of our cars 25-30%, right? Just to pay the wages, or we're going to have to lay folks off and still have to offer this car for more money so that we can stay in business, right? So in a short amount of time, it is the nature of the competition and who's going to win that competition, which is the driving force to war. Mm. We need to understand, let me put it plainly, right? Like, they talk about the business cycle. You hear that on every major news piece. Well, that business cycle within the capitalist dynamic, if you study it real hard, is also always preceded, preceded and followed. Their boom and bust is also always organized by these major reorganization of capital and capital reserves and the push for new capital stores and new capital stocks to take place to replenish. So it's called creative destruction. And that creative destruction is best facilitated by war. Hmm. Right? You destroy all the old factories, right? You decimate some of the old terms and relationships. You void all the old contracts. And then guess what? The capital that remains, that stays in place, they set new terms, they create new factories, they start the cycle all over again. That is what they're trying to do and reset it in the U.S.
That's why I've heard that phrase before, war is good for the economy.
Good for the economy.
In a capitalist society.
Yep, it's good for the economy. People should know that the one thing that the United States still clearly has an advantage on is what? The production
military power, yes.
That's it. And that is even being threatened. And so what they just broke down, again, Marco Rubio, go listen to one of his speeches that he gave about 2 weeks ago, where he talked about the United States can't produce one aircraft carrier and China's producing like 75 a year, or maybe 75 a month. Right, so that just shows you the disparity of where things are at, even in that field. And part of the rationale we need to be very mindful of and be very clear, right? If you know you're starting to lose the game by the rules that you set up, and you ain't got no intention on playing fair because you ain't never played fair, then what you gonna do? Right? You
I mean, that's why you set up the rules in the first place. Yeah,
you're going to try to fix the game, right? Or end the game. Mm-hmm. So that's where we at. I mean, I don't think it takes a whole bunch of complicated analysis. It's good to understand the intricacies of everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, but at the end of the day, the vicious folks who run the world intend on keeping it in their possession and control, and they have no intention on sharing. It ain't that complicated. Now, and the problem is its impacts affect us, and we got to work our way out of it because they're not going to solve this problem in our favor. And that's why we even try to articulate, laying out a series like this, right? And try to understand and get people to work on how these practices should scaffold in an interrelated way, right? Build upon each other, be integrated in practices on a communal level so we can work our way out of it. Now, we're not trying to develop, I want everybody to be clear, what we are articulating is not an autarkic program, meaning that, you just retreat into just some localized, system of production and only worried about your own. That's not going to save you, not in this dynamic, because again, one of the dynamics of capitalism, it always has to expand, whether that be internally or externally, right?
It has to expand.
And again, short of them colonizing the moon and the asteroids and Mars, they ain't got too much place to expand upon on this a good blue-green Earth. And so, you know, they got to those who own and controls the means of production are fighting this out in various different ways to reset who's going to be on top. Now, none of them be on top, and so that's why we're trying to execute a different type of program.
So I asked you that question about war. I cut you off. I'm not even sure where you were. Where were you, Carly, before I asked about war?
It gets into the critical piece. I was just trying to give a summary, in short, of what food sovereignty is and some of the components. The critical piece I want folks to end with there is it's the whole practice is really premised around agroecology, right? And integrating your farmer in a way that's going to actually work with, you know, the ecosystems of the place that you inhabit and getting to know those well, getting the TEK practices to the best of your ability. But one of the fundamental challenges that folks in a lot of different places have, and where I want to get into, I think the rest of probably the good chunk of this conversation, mm-hmm. is how do we start accessing land? Because that's the major challenge that I know most folks are going to have, right? And I'm quite sure that most of the people listening to this particular series are folks who live in urban environments where land is not that accessible. So let's talk about how do we start dealing with that, all right?
Okay. So
the first thing, I want you to put up the new graphic, right? And this piece that we've been trying to roll out, you probably have heard me say it before, but I want to start with this first piece. When and wherever we have access to land, you know, stop living to the best of your ability, you know, in the keeping up with the Joneses way, which is just having a bunch of green grass that you got to go out there and water and manicure that don't feed nothing because you ain't got no cows or goats to live in your environment. It's just there for aesthetics. Mm-hmm. Put that to use in creating a garden or community farm. Work with your neighbors to start integrating them to do the same. And work on creating forms of exchange between what you produce and they produce, so enough can be kind of a produce of tomatoes or cabbage or kale or greens that can not only feed the family that may occupy that space, but be able to feed other families down the road and trade and exchange and share. Because trust me, y'all, you know, there's this generalized notion out there that in order to survive hard times that you just got to go stock up on everything, right? and hoard it. Mm-hmm. And what I would tell you is right now, because of how rapid I think inflation is going to occur, I would go do some emergency shopping of some essential things. Without question, I would advise people to go do that. Mm-hmm. But understand that if you want peace, not everybody's going to be able to stock up like you, but they still live in your neighborhood. And if times really get rough, people are going to start roaming around looking for food, which means they might start roaming in your house looking for food. And if you don't have no relationship with them, right, where you can exchange, you know, food for labor, food for security, right, food for childcare, right, you may be in a tough situation where you're in an anti-communal state rather than building a communal state. So I'm not just advising people to like start talking to your neighbors to start doing food production just out of, charity, whatever the situation. Nah, you better mm-hmm. think about this as an element of your self-defense and communal self-defense. Because when times get tough, you're going to need the people around you to be standing with you, right? Mm-hmm. Not wondering about whether you're going to, shoot them, snitch on them, you know, steal from them. You're going to need a different dynamic and start getting in the habit of practicing that now. So this is why this first piece around getting in the practice of knowing your neighbor, talking to your neighbor is essential, old basics. But then let's look at the resources that are already in some utilization or some element that we can control. And that's what this whole piece of make every yard a farm, every garage a factory. Like, let's start with the basics of self-reliance that we can kind of build upon and then build out to build more communal systems of self-reliance and self-determination. Like, that's the critical piece. Now, knowing that, that's still not going to be enough, right? At least not in an urban area like Los Angeles or Atlanta or Chicago or New York and even a bunch of mid-sized towns. And this is where we're going to have to start tie this practice in. We're talking about the struggle for land. The basic element is around struggling to decommodify land wherever you are. Some of the lowest hanging fruits is start going to the various churches, synagogues, masjids, you know, that exist in your community to utilize their existing spaces to start putting them into collective productive rotation, right? And even if they don't necessarily have grass or soil, don't let that be a deterrent, right? Because you can set up hydroponic and aquaponic type systems, right? That you could easily create conditions to grow fresh produce, fish, crustaceans, service chickens, service, even in concrete urban environments, with the right knowledge and the right utilization of tools, right? And I would wager, right, going back to the first argument, is that if we seriously look at the abilities that have been built up over the past 30 years, particularly in the area around urban and, you know, small farm production, there's people doing this in cities, small towns, suburban areas, all over the place. Right, we need to tap into them, get them coordinated, have them teach those of us who don't know how to do this already so that we can engage in this and scale up and then create systems where we can exchange, you know, as much as possible based upon need, right, and rotational kind of assistance, i.e. the mutual aid component. That is the next kind of critical piece of where we can start that does not necessarily entail us getting into the immediate conflict with the state or other institutions of capital that don't want this change. But know this, even with that, it's probably not going to be enough. So you cannot avoid, I'm just here to stress, we cannot avoid at the end of the day engaging in an element of political struggle around opening up more public space for you. This is where some elements of a core municipalist movement we need to look at and engage. Like the where our program really grows out of a radical kind of municipalist program. We said that we want to set within one local environment, this being in Jackson, how to experiment and extract, you know, and exploring all these things in an integrated way. We still have a long way to go in that regard ourselves. But there are some basics that we have learned and been trying to share through this series around why you need to still kind of have this kind of municipal approach and what are some of the benefits it could yield. And it's important to start there in most cases than it is trying to do maybe at a state scale, at least for most of us within the United States, because most of us now live in states that are dominated by the Republicans. But we probably, those of us who are listening to this in the main point or be willing to adopt it, you still primarily live in an area run by Democrats or in other kind of progressive forces, be it the Green Party or Working Families Party, et cetera. And we can move those forces to move resources on the local level through applied pressure. And applied, we're going to have to do, right? And the first thing is get them to make all available public lands accessible and open it up so that groups and communities and individuals can maybe get plots or working kind of rotational systems to utilize that to put it in productive use, right? And create, you know, things like farmers markets so that people can exchange or buy what they need within that. But that is a piece that we need to start arguing for now, right, to meet the times and conditions that are coming, well, that are here, but also going to get worse in the days ahead. And the last piece relative to this kind of access to land, like on the municipal level, I would encourage folks to wage a struggle towards decommodifying them and establishing new commons, wherein there's a broad, a democratic orientation around how those lands will be stewarded in the process of this kind of handover and the long-term use, because the economy is being restructured, rearticulated. Trump did that. We are living in through an era that the global economy is not going to be the same, and our local economies are not going to be the same after what just took place last week. So we need to start thinking more long-term about how do we steward these lands, hold them in common, rather than fighting over them or having capital be able to swoop them up. And a broad, setting up community land trust or land banks or things of that nature need to be fought for so that there's a democratic right and democratic access towards them and reestablishing some commons. These are some critical things that I would put out to everybody, at least within the United States, needs to start arguing and fighting for if you're not doing it already. And I would guarantee you that there's somebody in your community who's already taking this up. Try to find them if you don't know them, where you can align with them in principle, work with them. If not, try to work on opening up spaces in the local environment around you in a broad democratic way.
So we have in the chat, Brooklyn Robbie says, I heard some years back of folks taking over golf courses. Heard of such, I assume?
Oh, yes.
Out here in Los Angeles, California/LA has droughts on a regular. And there have been reports of how golf courses and football stadiums and baseball stadiums use ungodly, obscene amounts of water and then don't pay their water bill. But right. If I don't pay my water bill, it gets turned off. So right. I'm not sure how we gonna commandeer Dodger Stadium or SoFi Stadium, but there's some golf courses out here that need to be taken over.
Golf courses, parks, mm-hmm. right? Abandoned buildings, parking lots. Look, there, abandoned homes. Right. There are plenty of spaces, at least in the U.S. context. There's plenty of spaces that could be used and need to be used and either put back into productive use or return back to the ecosystem. Right. So that we can create more balance within the local ecosystem so we can deal with things like drought and the forest fires and things of that nature that I know it just ravaged California that, people are already trying to forget about, this quickly, right? Mm-hmm. But that is on account of terrible land management. And I'm not blaming that on the state. The state facilitates the bad habits of capital to come in and move and develop things in LA where folks been told us, I wouldn't build there if I were you. I wouldn't do that if I were you. But instead of listening, folks started to build huge mansions up in the hills that just added to the soil erosion, the elimination of species, without understanding that those wild species naturally kind of contain a lot of the bush and the brush to keep it from becoming unmanageable and unburnable by eating it off and making sure that the predators make sure that the herbivores, their populations don't overgrow and create other different kind of problems.
The balance of the ecology.
Right. And we have to conscious of restoring balance. Right. And so.
But here's my thing, though.
Go ahead.
I took a trip to Detroit about 10 years ago. It was my first really time out there. And I had never seen so many abandoned homes. And I got so much love for my Detroit people. I apologize. I'm like, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. But isn't this illegal? How does this is blight. It's an eyesore. It's dangerous. How do all these houses just sit here? But the other thing I noticed was so many vacant lots, so much green space. And of course, we know about Baba Malik Yakini and the work that, or maybe y'all don't know about Malik Yakini and the work that they're doing in Detroit around food sovereignty and land use and community gardens. But when I see these abandoned buildings here in LA, in Leimert Park and other areas, black areas, where they've just been allowed to sit, the owner isn't getting the price they want for them, or they're chained up, or they're just out and blighted, and they just sit there for decades. The concept of private property, well, that's that man's building. He could do it what he wants. I think that if it's in our community and it's not being used and it's an eyesore and it's dangerous and we have a need, I think we should be able to commandeer that. So the question is, do we commandeer it or do we wait for a law from city council? Because after all, this is private property, you know.
The two are not, I think we got to get it out of here that the two are separate and distinct.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, to the extent that this is a democracy, which we know in truth it ain't, but to the extent that it's supposed to play by certain rules, it is our job to push it and to push the contradiction. Right? And part of what we're going to have to introduce, right, is re-articulating our understanding of restoring ecological balance, not just the social balance. You know, and part of what you just said was the social balance and it being an eyesore, all that is true. But in the larger sense of things, right, those things, you know, just sitting there in the state that they're in, they're not dealing with either the carbon cycle or the water cycle in any fundamental way to restore balance. So we have to extend our thinking, Tandy and everybody. I would argue that don't just put that in the communal context of how it relates to people, right? Put it in the broader context of how it should be relating to the environment. How it should be relating to the ecology. And one of the critical pieces around this particular framework, which, you know, because of trying to speak to some of the issues of the present time, and I really wanted to bring home this piece in practice for folks around accessing land. Because if we don't have, you know, the piece where I'm doing that, to reiterate, if folks don't, you know, if we don't assume getting access to sufficient amount of land in real time, then this, what we are articulating, is just kind of a pie in the sky. And we have to change that by changing the conditions on the ground that will enable us to both have access to land to then put these things in practice, right, under the terms and conditions that will meet communal needs. So trying to lay out the different levels and layers, starting from where you're at, your own yard, that of your neighbors, folks on your block, going to other low-hanging fruit, just to reiterate, start with the churches, mosques, other civic organizations that may have institutions, ask them to open it up, share that communal, and then you got to go to the level of where the municipal governments are, or where your county government are, to what they have access to. And so the first level is what they have access to. That is kind of nominally under their control. But the other part is what they could have access to. And that is where they could intervene to change the rules around dealing with the blight, and deal with either compensating, you know, owners. Let's say, if you're not going to do nothing with this, to put it in some kind of productive rotation, you know, we'll give you a percentage of it or whatever the situation is, or we will just commandeer it to put it to public, you know, use, one or the other, right? But those are terms and conditions that political movements in each corresponding community need to lay a groundwork on. But get yourself prepared, right? Because, you know, the ownership of land is one of the fundamental bases of where capital resides and how it dictates its terms of you know, the rule of capital, the dictatorship of capital. This is where it has to be broke. So you're not going to evade at the end of the day. We're not going to evade or sidestep having to engage in class struggle on this question. We are, right? Now, you may want to build up your ability to you know, go downtown and be able to check those folks by having a political movement that first started with building power with your, building a relationship to build power with your neighbor, then the other civic groups and other stuff. So you want to aggregate and organize and build up to that particular point. But rest assured, anybody listen to this, at some point for it to be critical, we're going to have to engage in frontal confrontation with the forces of the state and the forces of capital. There's no way around it. So we just need to figure out on whose terms and at what time those battles are going to be engaged, and try to engage them in our term by our organizing them based upon meeting people's needs, so that the outcomes when we choose to get there are decisive in our favor. That's the critical piece. I think we want to organize our way to understanding that we're going to have to get there in order to change this system and meet the needs of what, you know, people need in the real.
We're going to stop things right here. If you're just tuning in, we've been listening to Kali Ankuno from Cooperation Jackson, along with Thandi Chanmaringa from KPFK and Black Liberation Media. This was part three of the Build and Fight formula. You can hear the entire interview on Black Liberation Media or on hardknockradio.org. With that being said, we're out for now, and we will talk to you in the whirlwind. Peace.
Yeah. For all my peoples that's hungry. Shelter, a place to lay for rest when you stressed over life. Cause it's strife and ain't no God. I feel the winter heart creeping. Vicious is the wind, which is life when it's deep without a meaning. A tripe seen and screams, fiending. The pipe dream to some be seeming like the only way to keep breathing in the slums. But nothing comes, and keeping funds is like dreaming. My situation, no solution. Even the young become demons. Where I'm from, it's unyielding. Something like
that. Hey, hey, ho, 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 Hard Knock Radio. East, west, north, south, radio, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Round Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
Cable versus the Mediazillas! It's a bird! It's a plane! It's community radio!
This is Bird Note. Throughout winter, northern bobwhites gather in groups called coveys to search for food during the day and share warmth at night. These small quail arrange themselves in a circle with their tails in the center and heads outward, huddled up like a wreath of plump birds to survive frost and snow. But as spring arrives, the coveys disband and bobwhites seek out mates. Males whistle from shrubs and tufts of grass, hoping to catch the attention of a female. A bobwhite pair's first brood of young can come surprisingly early in the year, in April or May. The chicks hatch nearly ready to take care of themselves, but they need some help finding good places for food. For 2 weeks, the parents lead as many as 28 chicks around, scratching in bare ground and leaf litter for insects and other arthropods to eat. Bobwhites are themselves hunted by many other species, so they produce many offspring each year. A pair may have two or three broods of young, and each brood can contain over 24 eggs. Once winter returns, the bobwhites again join tight-knit coveys of around 10 birds, preparing to brave the winter. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
just what to do. And everybody says I'm just a fool over you.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m.